On March 8, 2014, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, known as MH370 or sometimes MAS370, took off from Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia and began flying in the direction of its planned destination, Beijing Capital International Airport in China. 38 minutes after the flight had taken off without incident, the captain confirmed his position with Malaysian air traffic control and wished them a good night as the plane crossed over into Vietnamese airspace. Those goodnight wishes would be the last radio communication anyone ever received from MH370. Only 2 minutes after the captain's goodnight, MH370 disappeared from air traffic control radar screens, and neither the plane nor any of the 239 people on board have been seen or heard from since. Today, in 2022, over 8 years after MH370 literally vanished into thin air, we still don't know exactly what happened, or even where the plane is, because after numerous searches over massive areas of ocean and sea, it has never been found. A piece or two eventually washed up on the shores of Africa, but only enough to simply confirm what had been assumed from the first week of the plane's disappearance, that MH370 had crashed somewhere in the vast Indian Ocean, a crash that nothing and no one could have survived. Almost nothing else is known about what actually happened on board Malaysian Flight 370, however. Who may have caused the crash, if it was a who at all? What actually happened on board in the hours the plane spent in the air after falling off radar? Where or when it actually went down? And most of all, why it went down at all? And over 2,000 miles south of where it had taken off, when it was supposed to be going north into China. What happened on Malaysia Flight 370 is truly a mystery, and one that, unfortunately, likely will never be solved. The greatest hope any of us might have, especially the family members of all the people who vanished with the plane, is actually finding enough of it to determine what the hell happened. But that's only if we find enough of it in the thousands and thousands of square miles it could be in. Somewhere out there, at the bottom of the sea. Hello, my creepy little sweeties. Welcome to Creeptastic, a podcast about horror, history, and perpetually perplexing humanity. I'm Caroline, and today I have decided to share a very creepy and infuriating mystery with you. What exactly was the plan that MH370 was supposed to follow that day back in 2014? And just how drastically did it deviate from those plans? What are the various theories, other than my personal one of alien abduction, that have been put forward to explain the little we actually know about this incident? Is it possible that this was truly some kind of bizarre accident? Or was it simply the willful and malicious intent of someone on board, maybe even one of the pilots? And of course, the question I had when I first heard about this case: how in the hell is it possible for an entire Boeing 777 jet with 239 people on board to just disappear? I'll provide some responses to these questions, but not necessarily answers, because the answers in this case are really fucking hard to find amidst all the damn questions. I'll also talk a little about mysterious plane disappearances in the landscape of the fictional horror world, and I've even found a little bedtime story which presents a rather sci-fi theory on the whereabouts of MH370 for you to entertain. Why provide you with more questions than answers for once? Because everyone loves an unsettling mystery. And though the actual disappearance of 239 human beings is tragic, the idea of one of the biggest jets flying the skies, literally disappearing into thin air, is pretty creeptastic. Few announcements before we get into the day's mystery. If you have been listening to Creeptastic and you are liking what you hear, then it would mean the absolute world to me if you left a review for Creeptastic wherever you might be listening to it. My highest priorities right now are getting some more listeners and definitely attracting more advertisers. And some nice reviews from you lovely folks is going to make a huge difference in that. Also know that there is more Creeptastic content to be had. If you head over to patreon.com/creeptastic, you will see a variety of bonus content that you are able to access if you decide to become a patron of the show. A mere $5 a month will get you the companion/after show, as told by Caroline, which comes out every single Friday. It will even get you a monthly bonus episode called Murder and a Movie, in which I take a pretty well-known movie and tell you about all the delightful things that happened in real life to inspire it. If that sounds remotely appealing to you, then you should definitely head over to patreon.com/creeptastic and maybe sign up to be one of my beautiful patrons. The more patrons I can get is also very helpful because this is a little homegrown podcast that I am doing all by my itty-bitty self. And so to keep it up, I'm gonna need to make at least a little bit of money doing it. And the last thing I'll say before we launch into our mystery is that I want to talk to you. I want to hear your thoughts. I want to hear your questions, your musings, your mental meanderings, if you will. I want to hear topic suggestions for shows. I want to hear feedback, and hardly anyone asks for that anymore. If you have literally anything that you'd like to say to me about the show, you can email me at caroline@creeptastic.com, or you can message me on any of my social media platforms, all the links of which can be found at creeptastic.com. I very much mean it when I say that I want to hear from you, so don't be shy. So now, let's get into Flight 370. First and foremost, I want to be very clear at the beginning of this episode that I recognize today I am talking about a real and fairly recent tragedy in which 239 people lost their lives. People who all had others who loved and cared about them, who are now left to suffer that loss. And that is truly terrible. I have all the empathy in the world for them. I cannot truly fathom what it might feel like to be in that kind of position, of having lost a loved one and having almost no real information about why or what happened to them, or even having a body to bury. I wanted to say all that because if by chance anyone connected to this incident ever listens to this, I want you to know that I have the utmost respect for your loss and your pain, and any of the jokes or snarky comments I might make in this episode are in no way intended to be hurtful or irreverent in any way. Believe me, I want to know what happened nearly as much as you do, and I'm really hoping for an explanation that hopefully doesn't cause any further pain to anyone. Whether or not that explanation will ever arrive, I don't know, but we can all still hope. I decided to feature this specific incident because my beautiful and supportive partner has a thing for airplanes. He doesn't fly them, but he gets super nerdy about how they're made, how they work, all the different models and designs. He plays pilot on a little flight simulator that he has on his computer almost every night, and it is so fucking adorable. What this fascination of his sometimes means is that I end up watching movies or TV shows about planes, whether I really care to or not. And that is how I ended up spending a couple hours recently watching a pretty well-done documentary on the disappearance of MH370, which I had not heard of before. By the end of that documentary, I was all kinds of riled up and feeling the need to share the madness with you, dear listener. So let's get creeptastic. Let's start with what we do know about what happened on flight MH370, which unfortunately is not a whole lot. And of course, always important to note that what we do have is in some cases still a matter of dispute, because why would anything be easy? That's just not how life works. Some of the things we know with absolute certainty are who was on board the flight and the condition everything was in when it took off from Kuala Lumpur. And by all accounts, that condition was normal. Everything was normal. Good inspections, flight crew showed up as planned. Everything and everyone seemed perfectly as it should be for a very standard Malaysia to China flight. One of two that was operated daily by Malaysia Airlines out of its hub at Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Regular flight, regular conditions, no alarm bells whatsoever. The flight was scheduled to depart Kuala Lumpur at 12:35 a.m. local time and arrive in Beijing about 5.5 hours later at 6:30 a.m. local time. And now I have to pause because I'm being reminded of the red-eye flights that I've been on and how fucking brutal they can be. I almost always sleep on planes for the entire flight if I can manage it, which is actually most of the time. But even if I sleep on a red-eye, there is just no feeling rested. Need a real bed for that. Alright, so at takeoff, all's well. Let's look a little more at the plane itself. Could there have been something wrong with it that no one had identified? Short answer, sure, that's always possible. But there's really nothing to indicate any kind of problem with the plane itself. Flight 370 was being operated with a Boeing 777 jet, which had been in use by Malaysia Airlines for almost 12 years at the time it disappeared. During that time, it had successfully accumulated 7,526 cycles, meaning takeoffs and landings, and 53,471.6 hours of flight time. It had completed its last aircraft maintenance check, or A-check as they're apparently known, less than 2 weeks before the MH370 flight. And at that time, the plane was found to be in compliance with all applicable airworthiness directives for both the airframe and the engines. The plane itself had experienced absolutely no major incidents of any kind in its lifetime. The closest it had even come to any kind of incident was back in August of 2012, when the 777 was taxiing and, made contact, we'll say, with the elevator of a China Eastern Airlines plane, which was just hanging out on the taxiway. To put it another way, the plane got a ding because it swiped a fucking parked car. How embarrassing. The mini collision broke off the tip of a wing and did some damage to the other plane, but there were sure as shit no fatalities or injuries to people of any kind. The damn thing didn't even make it off the ground. Can you imagine being the pilot responsible for hitting another stationary plane while you were taxiing? Talk about an epic fucking fail. That also fucked up a few hundred people's travel plans. Cause now you gotta deplane, figure all that shit out, put everyone else on different flights. What a fucking mess. I'm picturing the look on the face of whoever else was in the cockpit when it happened, and it's amusing to me. Damn it, Randy, we told you to keep your eyes on that giant fucking parked plane over there. Eyes on the road, man. Eyes on the fucking road. That little snafu aside, when it came time for Malaysia Flight 370 to hit the taxiway, the plane was in solid shape. What about the flight crew? There were a total of 12 crew members, consisting of 2 pilots and 10 cabin staff, or flight attendants, all of whom were citizens of Malaysia. The pilot in command of MH370, head honcho on board, was 53-year-old Captain Zahari Ahmad Shah from the Malaysian state of Penang. He had started working for Malaysia Airlines as a cadet pilot in 1981 and became a second officer after completing his training in 1983. He was promoted to captain in 1991 and had been flying the Boeing 777 since 1998. Now don't stress, I will do the math for you. That means that Captain Zahari had been a pilot for 33 years and had specifically been piloting the Boeing 777 for 12 years at the time MH370 disappeared with him at the controls. He had even been a type rating instructor and examiner for 7 years at that point. And in total, he had over 18,365 hours of flying experience, during which not a single passenger or plane was damaged or destroyed. His track record as a pilot was spotless. His co-pilot for Flight MH370 was First Officer Farik Abdul Hamid, who had accumulated 2,763 hours of flying experience and was on Flight 370 as a final training flight, which just kind of breaks my heart. He had formerly been a first officer for Boeing 737 planes, but began training to be first officer for the 777 in November of 2013. Had MH370 landed in Beijing as planned, Farik would have taken his final training exam for his promotion on his very next flight. Poor kid was only 27. Fucking hell. As far as the passengers were concerned, they were made up of a hodgepodge of travelers from all over the world who were on that particular plane for various reasons, as one would expect on a flight between two such major cities in the world. Of the 227 passengers, almost two-thirds were Chinese citizens returning home. 38 of the passengers were Malaysian and traveling somewhere from their home. The rest of the passengers came from 12 different countries, with a handful each from Australia, India, France, and the United States. Some were vacationing, others were on work trips. It was your standard makeup of human beings on a plane. Some were probably nice, and some were probably assholes. Some were old, some were young. Children, parents, brothers, sisters, friends, strangers. A seemingly random feeling gathering of people in a small confined space for a specified number of hours, just like any flight you or I might have taken or end up on someday. In the documentary I watched, which was produced by National Geographic, they interviewed several of the surviving family members of passengers, and the one that definitely hit me the hardest was a French man who looked to be in his mid to late 40s, and he had lost his wife and two children, his entire family, on Flight 370. That he wasn't in tears for the whole damn interview was impressive to me. I cannot imagine the pain of that kind of loss hitting you from every side. Not just losing one or two, but three family members, all the people that you spent your daily life with. Fucking horrific. There is one interesting thing to note about the passengers that came out after the plane disappeared and investigations were underway. When investigators took a closer look at everyone on board, they discovered that two passengers were not who their passports said they were. Two men from Iran had apparently come into possession of two stolen passports, one Austrian and one Italian, and they were traveling under those identities. Now I know what you might be thinking, and it is something that was most definitely brought up very quickly at the time. Is this a terrorist thing? Iranians with fake passports? You gotta ask, right? But I will tell you right now that both U.S. and Malaysian officials, as well as Interpol, thoroughly looked into the terrorism angle for everyone aboard and found absolutely nothing to suggest that the Iranians or any other passengers had any kind of terroristic intent or had fuck all to do with causing the disappearance of MH370. In fact, the best they could figure, the two Iranians were actually asylum seekers. So, about the furthest thing from a terrorist that you can be. So we have the plane, the crew, the passengers, and no fucking idea what happened to any of them. So let's run through the list of known events. We've already established that everything was all good at time of takeoff. We've got our passengers all nice and snug in their sardine seats, and our crew is doing their crew stuff, getting drinks together, snack time. Plane's in good shape, doing what it's supposed to do. The scheduled departure was 12:35 a.m., and actual takeoff from Kuala Lumpur occurred at 12:42 a.m. Shortly after departure, the flight was transferred from the airport's air traffic control to what is known as Lumpur Radar, the air traffic control frequency of the Kuala Lumpur Air Traffic Control Center. At 12:46, Lumpur Radar cleared MH370 to rise to an altitude of approximately 35,000 feet, which the captain confirmed they had reached at 1:01 a.m., and confirmed again 7 minutes later at 1:08 a.m. The final transmission, which would be sent from the aircraft itself, because everything is run on computers and linked up to satellites these days, was an automated position report, which also included data like total fuel remaining. The last verbal signal to air traffic control, meaning the last time anyone would hear from any actual person on board MH370, occurred at 1:19 a.m., less than an hour after takeoff, when Captain Zahari acknowledged the transition from Lumpur Radar to Vietnam's Ho Chi Minh Air Traffic Control with a simple, "Good night, Malaysian 370." Despite this acknowledgement of the change in air traffic control zones, no one from the plane would ever contact Vietnamese air traffic control. And the weirdness was only beginning. At 1:21 a.m., only 2 minutes after the captain's goodnight, Malaysia Flight 370 disappeared from radar screens in Kuala Lumpur and Ho Chi Minh. Because of how air traffic control works, however, this does not necessarily mean that anything of much significance happened to the plane itself at this point. Meaning, we can't just assume that, oh, well, that's when the plane went down. Nope, not that easy. Air traffic control uses what is known as secondary radar, which relies on a signal that is emitted by a transponder on each aircraft. Meaning, if that transponder is broken or not functioning for any reason, the plane attached to it stops appearing on air traffic controllers' radar screens. The last transponder data that MH370 sent out showed that it was at its assigned cruising altitude of 35,000 feet and was traveling a nice standard 542 miles an hour. Having not made contact with MH370 for 10 minutes, at 1:30 a.m., Vietnamese air traffic control asked the captain of another aircraft to attempt to contact the crew of Flight 370, because they hadn't been able to. That captain said that he was able to establish communication, but heard only static and what he described as mumbling. Ominous. Despite the fact that Flight 370 had fallen off of air traffic control radar, does not necessarily mean that it had fallen off of everyone's radar. We've all seen movies, we know what capabilities the military has. And it took a bit of time and cajoling for them to release their info, because who really wants the world to know about their military capabilities? But what happened to the plane's flight path next was revealed by what they've released. Almost exactly when the secondary radar transponder stopped functioning, military radar showed Flight 370 making a sharp left turn, almost describable as a U-turn, and start heading in a southwestern direction instead of the northeastern direction it was supposed to be going in. The plane continued to hover between 30 and 35,000 feet as it continued across the Malay Peninsula, And for better visualization of the area, I strongly recommend you check out the Instagram for this episode, Maps Galore. A civilian primary radar at a small airport on the peninsula registered an unidentified aircraft four times between 1:30 and 1:52 a.m., which lines up with the military data which was later collected. It was at this point that Vietnamese air control first contacted Kuala Lumpur air traffic control to let them know they had had no verbal contact with MH370. And it's not on their radar screens, so, you know, do you happen to know where the plane is? Kind of important information. But Kuala Lumpur did not know where the plane was. As far as any of the air traffic control centers knew at that point, Malaysia 370 could very well still be en route to Beijing as normal. Or it could be wildly off course. With no radar transponder signal and no response to communication attempts with the cockpit, there was no way of knowing. The data obtained later from military sources showed that at 1:52 a.m., the plane was detected passing just south of the island of Penang, the home of Captain Zahari. From there, the plane turned in a northwesterly direction, flying from Malaysia in the general direction of India. At this point, all the air traffic controllers were starting to lose their shit a bit, as they should. The plane has been off of everyone's radar for an hour, and that ain't good. At first, Malaysia Airlines Operations Center insisted that the plane was in Cambodian airspace, which it wasn't supposed to enter, and they quickly confirmed that Cambodian air traffic control was also not able to see or communicate successfully with Flight 370. At 2:25 a.m., about 2 hours into the flight plan, the satellite data unit on the aircraft responded to the hourly status requests which were being sent to it, and accurately registered a call which was made to the cockpit at 2:39, which went unanswered. Malaysia Airlines Operations Center was still confirming from signal downloads that the plane was in normal condition, despite maintaining radio silence and being, apparently, nowhere to be found. After another hour had gone by, at 3:30 in the morning, Malaysia Airlines had started singing a different tune, telling Kuala Lumpur Air Traffic Control that the locations it had provided to them earlier were, quote, based on flight projection and not reliable for aircraft positioning. Okay, then why'd you provide that information at all? Or at least, why didn't you clarify that when you gave them that info in the first place? Feels pretty unhelpful. Starting to feel like people are already trying to cover their butts. It was not until 5:30 a.m., more than 4 hours after communication was lost with MH370, that the watch supervisor at Kuala Lumpur Air Traffic Control pulled the trigger on initiating search and rescue for the plane. The fact that an entire Boeing 777 in their fleet had gone missing was officially announced by Malaysia Airlines 2 hours later, an hour after the scheduled arrival time of Flight 370 in Beijing. Maybe they were hoping it would magically appear there and they could all have a good laugh about it later. That was most definitely not the case. Another ground-to-aircraft telephone call was attempted to the cockpit of MH370 around the same time, but though it once again registered in the systems, pinging data back to the people on the ground, whoever was operating the plane, if anyone was operating it at all, simply was not picking up the damn phone. The initial press conference about the incident confirmed that neither the crew nor any of the aircraft's communication systems relayed any kind of distress signal, indications of bad weather, or technical problems before it vanished from radar screens. As far as anyone on the ground knew, the plane was in perfect condition, flying along like it normally would. But of course, that couldn't last forever, even if the plane really was fine. Because planes, in case you didn't already know, are powered by fuel. And at some point, no matter what condition the plane was in, it would have to return to the ground, either by landing or crashing. And as far as anyone knew, it was entirely possible that the plane might not be anywhere near a place it could land. Literally hours had gone by since it had fallen off radar screens, and with the information from the military radar still forthcoming, the jet could have gone in any number of directions, many of which pointed at nothing but open ocean. Malaysia Flight 370 had taken off with 82,000 pounds, or 37,200 kilograms, of jet fuel, which was enough to keep the plane in the air about 7.5 hours. That meant that by about 8 a.m., if MH370 had not already safely landed somewhere, its flight would be forced to come to a violent end. The final satellite status request, which was acknowledged by the aircraft's systems, occurred at 8:10 a.m. When the next was sent at 9:15, there was no response. So it's presumed that between those two times, Malaysia Flight 370 crashed with 239 people on board into the vast Indian Ocean. A few weeks later, when all the available data had been brought together and analyzed, the Malaysian Prime Minister confirmed that based on all they knew from all possible sources, the aircraft's final position before it truly and utterly disappeared and stopped responding in any way was in the middle of the southern Indian Ocean, hundreds, if not thousands, of miles from any kind of land. The inevitable conclusion was that the plane had to have gone into the water, and that all 239 people on board had to be dead. Once it became clear that rescue was no longer an option, the focus shifted to finding the plane, so we could at least try and figure out what the hell happened, and why those 239 people perished. But as I said earlier, only a handful of bits and pieces have been found which have been confirmed to be part of the plane, and nothing which has provided any kind of indication of what actually happened on Flight 370. I am not going to go into specifics about the various ways that they tried to calculate where to search. Suffice it to say that there are some very smart people out there who are very good at performing such calculations and factoring in shit like tides and currents. And those people initially said to start the search in a spot that Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott called, quote, as close to nowhere as it's possible to be. And that just makes the whole thing feel so much sadder and scarier to me. Just that idea of dying so far from everything that you know and love, with nothing around you but water, which you can't survive in, as far as the eye can see. Double fuck. The search moved steadily northward from that original spot as estimates about the radar track and fuel usage were revised and refined. And for our creeptastic purposes today, all you really need to know is that the possible search area is fucking massive. It encompasses literally hundreds of thousands of square miles of absolutely nothing but open fucking ocean. We are not talking about a needle in a haystack situation. We are talking about a needle in a hay warehouse, a hay convention center, a hay stadium. Bunnoodles. Bless their hearts for even trying. Between March 18th and April 28th of 2014, over 1.8 million square miles, or 4.6 million square kilometers, was searched by both sea and air, and absolutely nothing was found. Various other searches have occurred over the years, including underwater ones, but to no avail. The only evidence remaining of Malaysia Flight 370 found to date are the bits and pieces of debris which have been, quote, identified as being very likely or almost certain to originate from MH370, from beaches in Africa which face the Western Indian Ocean, where currents would have pushed anything that managed to float that long. And today, over 8 years later, all this information is still all we have to work with. So now it's time for the big question. What the fuck happened here? Let's talk theories. Because as far as all the official reports are concerned, they say the same thing, and that is, well, I don't know. The first theory is based on the fact that regardless of reason, what is known as an unresponsive crew event occurred. What does that mean? Well, it ain't good, and it's pretty straightforward. Unresponsive crew means just that. For whatever reason, crew can talk in the sense that radios are still working, etc., but they're not. Maybe the plane's been hijacked, maybe they're incapacitated somehow, maybe something's broken. Who knows? What we know with certainty is that the crew was most definitely being unresponsive. What we don't know is why. Was there some kind of hijacking or nefarious situation that rendered them unable or unwilling to get on the radio? The radio and other communication systems gave no indications whatsoever of being broken or dysfunctional in any way. So it does feel like this was a case of inability or unwillingness to continue communications. But which was it? Inability or unwillingness? The first theory of what happened on board is based on an assumption that those on the plane were simply unable to respond. There is a chance, of course, that this could be due to some kind of duress, but there is another, potentially more likely and definitely more terrifying explanation for the radio silence. Maybe everyone on board had been rendered unconscious or dead after falling victim to hypoxia. What the heck is hypoxia? Hypoxia is what happens to you when your body is deprived of enough oxygen at the tissue level. There's some oxygen around, just not enough to actually allow us to continue living, at least in the long term. Where do we tend to see this in the world? High, high, high up in the air. Top of Everest, let's say. Or in a plane flying at 35,000 feet, which isn't properly pressurized. Atmospheric pressure reduces with altitude, and with it, the amount of precious oxygen available to our poor little lungs. The reduction in the partial pressure of inspired oxygen at higher altitudes lowers the oxygen saturation of human blood, which ultimately leads to hypoxia. If this lower saturation of oxygen in our blood continues for long, eventually, we die. Let's take a little detour down a creeptastic side lane because this hypoxia on planes shit freaked me the fuck out when I really thought about it. Have you ever wondered why it's so important that aircraft cabins are pressurized? And by that I mean that they have air pumped into them to keep them at a particular atmospheric pressure. It's because, once we humans get to a certain altitude, there is just no longer sufficient oxygen in the air to meet all our pesky physical needs. And we are just not physically built to survive in pressure that is that different to the one we're used to at ground level. We're just not supposed to be up that high. And we really, really do need that oxygen. So yay for pressurized cabins! But what happens when an aircraft cabin loses the pressure it needs when it is cruising along at 35,000 feet? Decompression. And that can be pure hell on our bodies. According to the United States Federal Aviation Administration, the good old FAA, there are three distinct types of decompression events that can occur in aircraft. Gradual decompression, rapid decompression, and explosive decompression. We'll start with that last one because it is by far the gnarliest. Explosive decompression is what happens if something catastrophic happens to the structure of the airplane, which causes it to lose its pressure almost instantaneously, all at once. Boom, explosive. This kind of decompression occurs at a rate swifter than that at which air can escape from human lungs, which is typically less than 0.1 to 0.5 seconds. Let's pause and think about that. Explosive decompression forces the air in your lungs and any other air-filled cavities you have to be ripped from your body, but does it so fucking quickly that physically your body can't keep up. Instead, it suffers what is sometimes severe or even fatal trauma. The type of physical damage to a body caused by a difference in pressure between a gas space inside the body and its surrounding gas or fluid is known as barotrauma. Initial damage is usually due to the overstretching and rupture of the tissues, either directly because of expansion of the gas in the closed space, or by pressure difference hydrostatically transmitted through the tissue. So that air being ripped out of your lungs? Yeah, not much of an exaggeration. Barotrauma generally manifests as sinus or middle ear effects, lung overpressure injuries, and injuries resulting from external squeezes. Tissue damage and decompression sickness are caused directly and indirectly by gas bubbles within the body. Lung overexpansion may cause an arterial gas embolism, which is when air bubbles get in your blood flow, and you do not want that. We need air to live, but only if it's been properly processed. If air bubbles make it to our brain, our heart, or our lungs, they might just kill us. Ever hear of a diver with a popped lung? Yeah, that's what we're talking about. No bueno. Rapid decompression is slightly less horrifying because it takes more than 0.1 to 0.5 seconds. So thankfully, your lungs can at least decompress more quickly than the cabin around you does. Might still fuck you up a bit, but at least you won't pop your fucking lungs. Then there is gradual decompression, which to me is the most frightening because it is the most insidious. It is truly a silent killer that could sneak up on you and take you out before you even fucking realize it. This is because gradual decompression occurs slowly enough to go completely unnoticed by those who it is effectively killing. As hypoxia continues to develop, you'll start feeling fatigue, maybe numbness or tingling in your fingers and toes, maybe a little nausea coming up. As the hypoxia becomes more severe and your body continues to lack the oxygen it so desperately needs, shit just keeps getting scarier and deteriorating even further. You might experience confusion and disorientation, hallucinations, the type of intoxicated behavioral changes you might see in someone who's drunk, such as mental confusion, anger, poor judgment, and loss of muscle coordination, and or severe headache. There have been cases reported of aircraft crew members suffering from hypoxia who enter deep depressive states with a complete lack of will to conduct even simple tasks or calculations, or even responding to a situation with a behavior that is the exact opposite of what they should be doing. There have even been instances of crews intentionally depressurizing the cabin when there was a failure of the oxygen system. Vision becomes severely compromised as the ocular muscles become weakened and uncoordinated, and near vision becomes blurry as responses to visual stimuli become sluggish. Eventually, if the situation isn't corrected, which can only be accomplished by getting the oxygen your body desperately needs, you will lose consciousness. From there, your heart rate will continue to slow, and your blood pressure will continue to fall, until finally, your heart simply fails, and you slip into shock and death. That is what the first theory of what happened to Malaysia Flight 370 is saying has to be the explanation for its disappearance, and in particular, has to be the explanation for the lack of communication anyone on the plane had with people on the ground. The theory is that something, and no one is totally sure what, happened to the cabin pressure, which caused a gradual decompression, and everyone on board ended up slipping into unconsciousness and eventual death because of it. Hypoxia will set in more quickly the higher the cabin pressure altitude rises, occurring within a few minutes once the plane rises to between about 16 and 20,000 feet. At higher altitudes, if there is a sudden depressurization or some kind of cabin rupture, loss of consciousness can occur within a few seconds, and without any warning symptoms. Even if there are warning symptoms, the mental effects of hypoxia might make someone essentially incapable of even recognizing the danger they're in. There have been cases documented of pilots needing to be convinced over radio by people on the ground that they were suffering from hypoxia. The timeline from initial hypoxia to death or brain damage is directly related to the degree of oxygen deprivation. The more deprivation there is, the quicker death will occur. If Malaysia Flight 370 did suffer a decompression issue, it is possible that everyone on board, including the pilots, could have been rendered unconscious or dead within minutes. And planes being built the way they are, it is entirely possible for a plane in autopilot to just keep flying, even if every single person on board is dead, until all the fuel is used up and it has to go down. This hypoxia theory is pretty damn strong, because to my absolute and abject horror, I discovered that this has most definitely happened on flights before. Often enough for it to be a major point of training for pilots to watch out for any possible signs of hypoxia in themselves or anyone else. I feel like I would have been happier on planes for the rest of my life if I didn't know that. The most well-known flight which crashed as a direct result of hypoxia was Helios Airways Flight 522, which was traveling from Cyprus to Athens in August of 2005. As the plane continued to climb after takeoff, the pilots failed to recognize that the cabin pressurization system was set to manual control instead of automatic, which they either assumed it was in or were just used to it being in. Either way, they thought the cabin was pressurizing automatically when it was actually waiting for them to hit a damn button. This led to the plane not pressurizing as it should have, which quickly led to hypoxia of everyone on board, including the pilots. The plane ended up flying in radio silence on autopilot in a loop over Greece for several hours before it exhausted its fuel and crashed into the mountains. 121 people suffocated to death in the air, and their plane just kept on flying until it ran out of gas and fell from the sky. Ugh. I honestly can't even think about that without shuddering. A plane full of dead bodies, flying to nowhere, and there is absolutely nothing that anyone can do. Fucking hell. Is what happened to MH370 similar to what happened on the 2005 Helios flight? It's possible. It would easily explain the lack of responsiveness from any actual humans over the course of several hours, and might even explain why the plane suddenly flipped a bitch and started heading south to bumfuck nowhere in the Indian Ocean. Maybe hypoxia was making the pilots a bit loopy before they went unconscious with the autopilot on, and the plane just kept flying until it went down. But if that is what happened, then it begs the question, how did the cabin lose pressure in the first place, if that's what happened at all? Ultimately, there's only two options. That something related to the cabin pressurization systems broke or malfunctioned, or that someone on that plane willfully caused cabin pressurization to fail. None of the data received from the plane whenever it auto-pinged with the ground indicated that anything was wrong with it. And it feels unlikely to me that an issue which would result in depressurization of the plane wouldn't register with any of the systems on board. So that leaves the other option, which is that someone turned cabin pressurization off and would have had to do so deliberately. Because believe me, they do not design these things so that a random elbow hitting a button would turn off the fucking air in the plane. Which brings us to the second theory, that this was a suicide by pilot situation, either with or without the hypoxia element. Unfortunately, this is also not unheard of in the aviation world. In fact, I know you've seen this kind of thing before, because you have to know about 9/11. That was suicide by pilot. Deliberately crashing a plane so that you and everyone else on board dies, and maybe some people on the ground do too. It is by far one of the absolutely most fucked up ways to kill yourself, if not the most fucked up. Why take even one other human being with you, let alone over 200 of them? Fucking hell. This theory, which many agree is the most likely explanation for what happened, is that for whatever reason, one of the pilots on board MH370 deliberately chose to fly the plane where it ended up going, which was essentially a point of no return, and may even have murdered everyone on board via hypoxia before crashing the plane into the sea, so that they could do so without fear of any resistance. I want to be very clear when I say that there is zero, and I mean absolutely zero, physical evidence to support this theory. It is 100% speculation. And to people who knew the pilots of MH370, the idea that either of them could have deliberately done such a horrible thing makes no sense at all. Neither of them were reported as having any mental health issues, making strange statements, behaving oddly. They had spotless work records. In the case of Captain Zahari, over 30 years worth of a spotless record. Co-workers described them as kind, non-violent, the kind of people that would absolutely, under no circumstances, do such a thing. There was just no motive for either of them to crash that plane, especially the way it was crashed. Let's play devil's advocate. If that crash was some kind of deliberate attempt to make some kind of statement, the way 9/11 was, then why would you crash it in the middle of the Indian Ocean without leaving any kind of indication in any way as to what your big statement was? And if it was nothing more than a pilot giving into depression and choosing to end his own life, why would either of these men have chosen to take an entire plane full of people with them? Apparently, there were no signs that either pilot would do either of those things. But humanity and the world being what it is, you gotta wonder, do we ever really know the people around us? Do we ever really know what they're capable of? I don't know that we do, and I definitely don't know those pilots. Maybe no one really did. Based on everything that is known, hypoxia on autopilot seems to make the most sense. It explains why the plane stayed in the air for the amount of time it had fuel for, and why absolutely no one on it was responding to or initiating any kind of communication. Because remember, the phone wasn't busted, it just wasn't answered. The radio wasn't busted, it just wasn't being responded to. And to me, that says that there is no one there who can answer, or that no one is alive. And unlike a car on a highway, which would crash almost immediately if someone died or left the wheel, a plane on autopilot has been proven on multiple occasions to be perfectly fine running itself for hours until it inevitably runs out of fuel. What I cannot say with any certainty at all, and why this case is so infuriating to me, is why the hypoxia might have occurred. Could it have been some kind of mechanical or technical issue? Just a switch in the wrong position type thing like the Helios flight? I haven't found anything to suggest that that is totally impossible. But it does seem unlikely, given the lack of any kind of distress or error signals from the plane. What investigators tend to agree is more likely is the dreaded human element, whether the actions of those humans were willful and malicious or not. Did someone accidentally cause the cabin pressure to fuck up, and before they could realize it, they were already too far gone to do anything about it? Or did someone deliberately cause MH370 to crash and committed one of the most horrific and senseless mass murders in the process? I don't think we'll ever know. In the absence of more solid information, I am not going to say that either of those pilots did anything wrong, because I do not have any evidence that I could back that up with. As was the case when it first happened, the only things that can be said for sure is that Malaysia Flight 370 took off as planned from Kuala Lumpur, and for any reason or no reason at all, it was flown to the middle of nowhere, almost as if someone didn't want it to be found, and took 239 people with it. What do you think happened, dear listener? If it was one of the pilots, where the hell is the motive? If it was meant to be some kind of statement, what the hell is that statement? If it was some kind of mechanical or technical issue, then why the hell did all the data pinging from the plane keep saying nothing was amiss? Ugh. See what I mean? Fucking infuriating. That an entire jumbo jet with 239 people on it can just disappear from radar screens and never be seen or heard from again is fucking mind-boggling to me, as much as it is utterly terrifying. And so, of course, it's also kinda creeptastic in a way. You could make a dozen different horror movies about what happened to MH370, ranging from the real to the surreal and everything in between. Alien abduction? Maybe. Some other supernatural reason. If that's your jam, sure. Some dark but painfully normal reason, like a pilot losing their shit mid-flight. We just don't know. And that always makes for good horror fodder. Speaking of horror fodder, how often do we see the mystery flight show up in the fictional world? It is there a little bit, but usually, fairly quickly into the story, you get to know what the hell happened. And the explanation is usually not going to come from the realm of what we understand to be reality. There's a TV series that has been out for a few seasons and is on Netflix called Manifest, which I felt the need to mention even though it's not technically of the horror genre. Horror adjacent, maybe, in the supernatural realm of things. The basic gist is that a plane full of people experience some turbulence in the air and then proceed on their merry way and land at their planned destination. The twist is that they land over 5 years after they were supposed to, and long after they were all presumed dead. Just like Malaysia Flight 370, as far as anyone on the ground was concerned, their plane had just vanished into thin air without any explanation. Even though I don't really believe in the supernatural, there is a small part of me that hopes, somehow, in some universe, that this could end up being the case for MH370. It's sad, but also somewhat comforting to imagine that Flight 370 might just magically reappear where it was supposed to be and land in Beijing as if nothing had happened. I know that's a fantasy. I know that's not going to happen. But sometimes it's okay to indulge a fantasy, especially if you're living in a perpetually sad reality. When it comes to disaster in the air movies, and ones that are most definitely of the horror genre, you generally always get to see what is happening to cause the flight to go wonky. and it usually has to do with something or someone going very, very wrong. In the 2020 movie Horizon Line, a couple on a chartered flight have to take over and try and survive when their pilot has a heart attack and dies in mid-air. Ugh. So this pair of people with next to no flying experience and definitely no experience landing or taking off in a float plane have to figure out how to get the plane back down without crashing or running out of fuel, which of course means they'll crash anyway. One of those harrowing survival story thriller type movies. Definitely horror adjacent. In 2018, a horror movie came out called Flight 666, which honestly, just from the title, you can tell is going to be cheesy as fuck. Did not get good reviews. Preview didn't leave me with any strong feelings. Seems to have gone your typical supernatural route. Plane takes off, creepy shit starts to happen, people start to see things, controls in the cockpit start to go wonky, shenanigans ensue. Looks like it could be good for a super late sleepless night, if it's good at all. A 2012 movie called 407 Dark Flight went a similar direction with the supernatural, but in this case, the plane everyone's on does have a dark history. It had previously been in a crash, in which hundreds lost their lives, and it has now been recommissioned and sent into the air again. Ghastly and ghostly happenings will start to occur, and people will start to die, one by one. Sounds kinda creeptastic, depending on the explanation they go with for why people are dying. Going down the supernatural road again is the 1981 film The Survivor, which I had not heard of before I researched this episode, and it kind of sounds like an interesting take on the whole death in the skies thing. There is most definitely a plane crash, and as the title probably makes clear to you, only one survivor, the pilot himself, and he doesn't have a scratch on him. He joins forces with a psychic and a priest. Sounds like the basis for a good joke. To figure out what the hell happened, who the hell is responsible, and how the hell he can help the 300 souls who died on his watch. It's a British flick. The effects look pretty basic. It was 1981, after all. But it also looks like it could be one of those older horror movies that just makes me happy somehow. So I might check that one out. Other than some kind of supernatural force or being on board, the world of fictional horror has not really dug too deep into the whole disappearing plane storyline. But I think there is a hell of a lot of potential for that. And who doesn't love a good scary plane disaster movie? Am I right? Since I wasn't able to find very many horror movies that really spoke specifically to this week's topic, I have decided to go a different direction in selecting a movie for your spoiling this week. Every week in the companion show for Creeptastic, as told by Caroline, I spoil a horror movie. In other words, painstakingly walk you through it and talk about its production. And most of the time, I try to pick a movie that is related to the topic of the week. Some weeks, that just doesn't make sense for, and this week feels like one of them. So I've decided to institute a wildcard system, in which if I can't find a decent enough horror movie that's related to the topic, I am just going to go to my wildcard list and find a random horror movie that I have not seen yet and do that for the spoiling. And in order to avoid things getting too shitty, I've decided to utilize RottenTomatoes.com list of the 200 best horror movies. So hopefully I don't end up stuck with anything that I really don't like. And the winner this week is Carrie, 1976. I have seen this movie before, but it was a really long time ago, and I only kind of remember the beginning, not so much of the end. We all know generally what happens in Carrie, but it's a classic for a reason. If you'd like to join me for the spoiling this week, head over to patreon.com/creeptastic and sign up to be at least a $5 or higher patron. That will get you access to all the As Told by Caroline episodes, including all of the ones that have already been produced which is quite a back catalog for you. Those options again are at patreon.com/creeptastic. Feel free to check it out. So before I read you a little bedtime story that offers an alternative theory as to what happened to Malaysia Flight 370, what have I taken away from this episode? First, that regardless of what happened on Malaysia Flight 370, or why, it is most definitely one of the worst plane-related tragedies to ever have occurred. 239 people have been presumed dead for over 8 years. And compounding the devastation of that is the fact that we still don't know why, and might never know. That is crazy-making. Second, that death by hypoxia on a plane is fucking terrifying, and I, for one, am probably going to be watching everyone around me for signs of it on every plane I get on for the rest of my life. I'm a stats girl, and I know the odds of me dying on a plane, whether it's in the air or on the ground, are stupid small. But still, the idea of a plane full of people all just slipping away into unconsciousness and death, and their plane flying their bodies around for however much longer it stays in the air. Yeah! Gives me the goddamn heebie-jeebies. No thank you, sir. And mini PSA for the day. If you're on a plane and that oxygen mask ever actually drops down from the ceiling, you better take that shit seriously. Get that fucker on your face ASAP. And don't you dare assist anyone else first, including that cute kid next to you, because the time it takes you to help them could very well cost you your consciousness, if not your life. See the mask, wear the mask, breathe the oxygen. And finally, because I'm still left to think about the poor friends and family for everyone on board MH370, remember to tell your loved ones how important they are to you, and make sure you appreciate them today. Don't wait for tomorrow. Because it is rare, but sometimes life just happens when we least expect it, and people really can just disappear into thin air. On that happy note, it's story time. The story that I have found for you was written by Amandeep Singh and is titled The Missing Plane. Enjoy. All the sand here is white. It feels wonderfully fresh and moist beneath my withered brown feet as I walk upon the barren land. I've made it a habit to make a complete tour of the region each day at dawn. It's nice to have something to do. Like each day, without fail, my first observation is the plane upon which I and my crew embarked on a mission to locate the missing plane MH370 of Malaysia over the southern Indian Ocean. The voyage reflected hopelessness in itself, because it had been well over a year since the plane had gone missing. As we approached the area where MH370's radar signals had last emanated from, we encountered a strange cloud phenomenon, a tunnel-shaped vortex looming up menacingly straight ahead of us. Like excess water gushing into a gutter, our plane flew directly into it, scraping its wings on the way. All the electromagnetic instruments malfunctioned, and the magnetic compass spun inexplicably. No one had any idea as to what was going on. As the tunnel's end caught our eye, we expected to see clear blue skies. Instead, a terra incognita greeted our eyesight. The sky was a morose gray, and a small white strip of land, outshining the dark green water around it, lay underneath us. Without resting, I tread ahead with my feet sinking in the sand. My plane's derelicts stretch up to 2.75 kilometers, or so I've measured. The last component to be spotted is the landing gear of the plane, which deserted us the earliest. I ordered the pilots to land because we were running low on fuel. The journey through the mystical tunnel had taken about 5 hours. Gazing from above, the land seemed solid, but we were caught unawares when our plane, approaching at 120 knots, descended into the sand. A major upheaval followed that altered the entire body of the plane. I am assured now that I am the sole survivor of the wreckage. On my first day here, I discovered some blood on the sand, devoid of corpses. Maybe they had sunk within the earth, or whatever planet this was. Yet every day I hoped to see a companion, dead or alive, whom I could lament with or grieve for. Strutting ahead, I approach the stellar zone, as I call it. The divergent light rays from distant stars strike only at this location, molding up the sky around it as a black carpet with multicolored glitter sprinkled over it. It's my favorite spot. Everything has changed since my arrival on this no man's land. The surroundings are bare and rugged, offering no succor to the weak-hearted. However, it isn't easy to give up. The mind clings on to hope desperately, afraid to let go, and that made me thrive in this locale. Every day, I compose letters or notes like this one and float it beyond the horizon. The green water here doesn't wet things properly. It had occurred to me to sail upon the ocean myself in a similar manner, but the hurricanes lined up along the horizon bound me to the territory. As best I can guess, the visible mass of clouds and dust in the distance is actually some kind of wormhole, and I can see infinitely many of them enveloping the skyline. I don't know which of them lead home. With the notes I unleash into the ocean every day, I feel I have the possibility of at least one of them making it to Earth, to someone's hand. Maybe they would believe it or not, but I know it to be true. If God created zillions of natural items, then some of them are bound to be supernatural. I want to erect some kind of pyramid structure that could serve as a tomb for all the lives lost here, the souls forever reposing in peace, but the bodies never found. When I die, I know I'll be dissolved within the sand, but I know I should leave my mark. Maybe, someday, it might be acknowledged. Moving on, I near the end of the island that I am marooned upon, as well as the prize we had put the effort in for. Each day, I gaze intently at the shore, for there is the missing plane, Malaysia Flight 370, right before my eyes, in its eerie tranquility, devoid of humans, but saturated with vehement emotions characteristic of humans, like helplessness, grief, and insanity, which might have greeted the passengers when they first trudged upon this appalling land. Godspeed. The end. That was a short story, but I found it very haunting. That is what I have for you for this episode of Creeptastic. I really hope that you enjoyed it. If you did, you should definitely leave me a review wherever you have listened. You should also head over to patreon.com/creeptastic and check out all of those fun options. Anything you might need to say to me, I am open to hearing, and you can reach me at caroline@creeptastic.com. The website again is creeptastic.com. I am Caroline. I hope you have a wonderful, fabulous week and that you make it to all your planned destinations without incident. And of course, keep being your creeptastic self.